"I must clean the wounds," she told him. And quickly, before her conscience could prevent it, she tipped the raw brandy into the wounds and swabbed them out. Tipu sat still as a temple carving of a Hindu devil, making no acknowledgement of the harsh spirit burning open tissue. Robin tied off the vessels with silk thread, leaving an end hanging from the wounds, and then she sutured the lips closed, laying precise, neat stitches, and pulling them up tightly so that the smooth, bald scalp came up in a sharp little peak of flesh with each tug. "I'll pull the thread when the vessels mortify," she told him. "The stitches will be ready to come out in a week." She would not deplete her stock of laudanum, she decided. The man obviously was impervious to pain, and she was still in the throes of unchristian spite. Tipu lifted the round head. "You good doctor," he told her solemnly. And she learned then a lesson that would last her throughout her life. The stronger the purge, the more astringent or foul-tasting the medicine, and the more radical the surgery, then the more impressed with the surgeon's skill was the African patient. "Yes," Tipu nodded gravely. "You one bloody fine doctor." And he opened one huge paw. In his palm lay the scalpel that Robin had lost in Huron's hold. Without expression, he placed it in Robin's own unresisting hand, and with that eerie swiftness was gone from the saloon, leaving her staring after him. Huron flew southwards, meeting the long South Atlantic rollers and spurning them carelessly, brushing them aside with her shoulder and letting them cream over her rail and then tumble away astern in a long, smooth wake. There were seabirds in company with them now, beautiful gannets with yellow throats and black diamonds painted around their eyes, coming in from the east and soaring above their wake, shrieking and diving for the galley scraps when they were thrown overboard. There were seals, too, lifting their whiskered heads high above the surface to stare curiously after the towering clipper as she burst the sea open with her sharp bows in her flight into the south. Smeared across the brilliant blue water were long serpentine trails of sea bamboo torn from the rocky shoreline by the gales and storms of this uneasy and troubled sea. All these were indications of the land, which was always just below the eastern horizon, and Robin spent many hours of each day alone at the port rail staring towards it, longing for another glimpse of it, smelling the dryness and the spiced aroma of its grass and herbs on the wind, seeing its blown dust in the marvellous reds and glowing gold of the sunsets, but denied sight of it by the offing that St. John was making before coming back onto the starboard tack for the final run into Table Bay. However, as soon as Mungo St. John appeared on his quarterdeck, Robin would hurry below without another glance in his direction, and she locked herself in her cabin, brooding there alone, so that even her brother sensed that something troubled her. He tried a dozen times to draw her out. She sent him away each time, refusing to open the cabin to him. "I'm all right, Zuger, I just want to be alone." And when he tried to join her in her solitary vigils at the ship's rail, she was short and unbending, exasperating him, so that he stamped away and let her be. She was afraid to talk to him, afraid that she would blurt out her discovery of slaving equipment in Huron's hold and put him in deadly danger. She knew her brother well enough not to trust his temper and not to doubt his courage. Neither did she doubt Mungo St. John's warning. He would kill Zuger to protect himself. He could do it himself. She had seen him handle a pistol, or she could send Tipu to do the work in the night. She had to protect Zuga until they reached Cape Town, or until she did what she had to do. "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." She had found the passage in her Bible and studied it carefully, and then she had prayed for guidance, which had not been given, and she had ended more confused and troubled than she had begun. She prayed again, kneeling on the bare deck beside her bunk, until her knees ached, and slowly her duty became clear to her. 3,000 souls sold into slavery in a single year? That was what the Royal Naval Captain had accused him of. How many thousands before that? How many thousands more in the years to come, if Huron and her captain were allowed to continue their depredations, if nobody could prevent them ravaging the east coast of Africa. Her land, her people, those peoples whom she was sworn to protect and minister to, and to lead into the fold of the Saviour. Her father, Fuller Ballantyne, was one of the great champions of freedom, the unrelenting adversary of this abominable trade. He had called it the running sore on the conscience of the civilized world that must be rooted out with all the means at our disposal. She was her father's daughter, had made her oath in the sight of God. This man, this monster, epitomized the sickening evil and monstrous cruelty of the whole filthy business. "Please show me my duty, O Lord," she prayed. And always there was her own guilt and shame. Shame that his eyes had probed her half-naked body, that his hands had touched and fondled her. Shame that he had debased her further by stripping bare his own body. Hastily she thrust the image aside. It was too clear, too overpowering. "Help me to be strong," she prayed quickly. There was shame and there was guilt. A terrible, corrosive guilt in the fact that his gaze, his touch, his body had not revolted and disgusted her, but had filled her instead with a sinful delight. He had tempted her to sin. For the first time in all her 23 years, she had encountered real sin, and she had not been strong enough. She hated him for that. "Oh, show me my duty, O Lord," she prayed aloud and rose stiffly from her knees to sit on the edge of a bunk. She held her well-worn, leather-bound Bible in her lap and whispered again, "Please give unto your faithful servant guidance." And she let the book fall open, and with her eyes closed, placed her forefinger on the text. When she opened her eyes again, she gave a start of surprise. Guidance obtained by this little ritual of hers was usually not so unequivocal, for she had chosen Numbers 35, verse 19. "The revenger of blood himself shall slay the murderer. When he meeteth him, he shall slay him." Robin had no illusions as to the difficulty she would have in performing the heavy duty placed upon her by God's direct injunction, or how easily roles might be reversed, and she become herself the victim rather than the avenger. The man was as dangerous as he was wicked, and time was against her. The accurate observation of the sun that Zuga had made at noon that day placed the ship within 150 miles of Table Bay, and the wind stood fair and boisterous. Dawn the next day would reveal that great flat-topped mountain rising out of the sea. She had no time for elaborate planning. Whatever she did must be direct and swift. There were half a dozen bottles in her medicine chest, whose contents would serve. But no. Poison was the most disgusting of deaths to inflict. She had seen a man die of strychnine poison when she was at St. Matthew's. She would never forget the arching spine as his back muscles convulsed until the man stood on the top of his head and on his heels like a drawn bow. It must be some other means. There was the big naval Colt revolver which Zuga kept in his cabin. He had instructed her in its loading and discharge. Or there was the Sharp's rifle. But both of those belonged to her brother. She did not want to see him swinging from the gallows on the parade ground below the castle at Cape Town. The more uncomplicated and direct plan, the greater was its chance of success, she realized, and at the thought she knew just how it must be done. There was a polite knock on her cabin door, and she started. "Who is it?" "Jackson, doctor." He was the captain's steward. "Dinner is served in the saloon." She had not realized how late it had grown. I will not be dining tonight." "Hey, you must keep your strength up, ma'am," Jackson entreated through the closed door. "Are you the doctor, then?" she asked tartly, and he went shuffling off down the companionway. She had not eaten since breakfast, but she was not hungry. Her stomach muscles were rigid with tension. She lay a while on her bunk, gathering her resolve, and then she stood up, selected one of her oldest dresses in a dark, heavy wool. It would be the least loss to her wardrobe, and the dark colour would make it less conspicuous in the shadows. She left her cabin and went quietly up to the main deck. There was no one but the helmsman on the quarter-deck. his weathered brown face lit faintly by the binnacle lamp. She moved quietly across to the skylight of the saloon and looked down. Mungo St. John sat at the head of the table, with a joint of steaming salt beef in front of him. He was carving thin slices of meat, laughing across the board at one of Zuga's sallies. One quick glance was enough. Unless there was a call from the lookout or a need to change sail, Mungo St. John would not move for another half hour at the least. Robin went back down the ladder past her own cabin and down the companionway to the after quarters. She reached Mungo St. John's quarters and tried the door. Once again it slid open easily. She stepped through and closed it behind her again. It took her only a few minutes to find the case of pistols in the drawer of the teak desk. She opened it on the desk top and took out one of the beautiful weapons. The mottled Damascus steel barrels were inlaid with bright gold, a hunting scene with horses and hounds and huntsmen. Robin sat down on the edge of the bunk, held the weapon muzzle up between her knees while she unscrewed the silver powder flask and measured the fine powder into the cup. It was a familiar chore, for Zuga had spent hours in her instruction. She rammed the charge down into the long, elegant barrel under the felt wad, and then selected a perfect sphere of lead from the ball compartment of the case, wrapped that in an oiled patch of felt to give it a close fit into the rifled barrel, and then rammed it down on top of the powder charge. Then she reversed the pistol, pointing it down at the deck, while she fitted one of the copper percussion caps over the nipple of the breech, drew back the hammer until it clicked at full cock, and laid it on the bunk beside her. She did the same with the other pistol, and when they were both loaded and cocked, she placed them on the edge of the desk, butts towards her, ready for immediate use. Then she stood, and in the centre of the cabin lifted her skirts around her waist and loosened the drawstring of her drawers. She let them fall to the deck, and the air was cool on her naked buttocks, so that she felt the little goose pimples rise on her skin. She dropped her skirts and picked up the cotton undergarment. Holding it across her chest, she tore it half through and threw it across the cabin. Then she took the fastenings of her bodice in both hands and ripped them down almost to her waist. The hooks and eyes hung on the torn threads of cotton. She looked at herself in the polished metal mirror on the bulkhead beside the door. There was a luster in her green eyes, and her cheeks were flushed. For the first time in her life, she thought her image beautiful. No, not beautiful, she corrected herself, but proud and wild and strong as an avenger should be. She was glad he would see her like this before he died, and she lifted her hand and rearranged one of the thick tresses of hair that had broken free of its retaining ribbon. She sat back on the bunk and picked up a loaded pistol in each hand. She aimed first one and then the other at the brass handle of the door, and then laid them in her lap and settled down to wait. She had left her watch in her own cabin, so she could not tell how long she waited. The voices and laughter from the officer's saloon were completely muffled by the closed door, but every time a plank creaked or some part of the ship's gear clattered, her nerves sprang tight, and she lifted the pistols to cover the doorway. Then suddenly she heard his footsteps. There was no mistaking them for any other man aboard. They reminded her somehow of a caged leopard pacing its bars, quick, light, and alert. He was on the deck above her, but the footsteps were so close that it seemed he was in the cabin with her. She looked up at the deck, swinging her head slightly to follow his turns from one side of the quarter-deck to the other. She knew what he was doing. She had watched him on a dozen other nights. First he would talk quietly with the helmsman, checking the slate on which the ship's course was chalked, before going back to inspect the log trailing astern. Then he would light one of his thin black Havana cigars and begin pacing the deck, with his hands clasped in the small of his back as he walked, darting quick glances up at the trim of his sails, studying the stars and the clouds for signs of change in the weather, pausing to feel the send of the sea and the run of the ship under him, before pacing on again.